What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. I hate the sun. Let's go inside, will ya?
What else do you hate?
I hate the ocean, and I hate the beach, and I hate the sun, and the grass, and the trees, and I hate heat.
Adam and I may not be quite so averse to the summer sun as Harvey Keitel's Charlie and Mean Streets, but we're ready to turn our attention to the change of season and to things we like with our top five most anticipated fall movies.
Among those anticipated movies, 40 years after Mean Streets, Martin Scorsese's latest The Wolf of Wall Street with Leonardo DiCaprio. We'll see if it makes the cut.
Plus, a review of the new martial arts biopic The Grandmaster from director Wong Kar-wai, and the first film in our six-part Korean auteurs marathon, 2004's Three Iron. That and more.
Mispronunciations will abound.
Better believe it. Ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over a million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level.
For 25% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM9.
You're listening to Film Spotting. It may not feel like autumn yet, but just wait. Before you know it, the sequels and the superheroes will be flying out of multiplexes, and the prestige pictures, burdened under the weight of their self-importance, will come lumbering in. Our fall movie preview is later in the show.
But first, I pit my Bagua technique against Adam Xingyi in our review of The Grandmaster.
His name is Ip Man. Before he trained legends, he had to become one.
One way to describe a Wong Kar-wai movie would be to call it a ceremony. In films like In the Mood for Love and 2046 especially, the narrative takes a backseat to gestures, artifacts, fashion, the sort of things that rituals and ceremonies usually consist of. If Wong is exploring a theme in one of his films, it often arises out of these elements rather than something like plot or even character. It strikes me that the biopic genre values the exact opposite. Specific dates, information, and chronology, those are the tools of its trade. So what happens when Wong Kar-wai comes up against the biopic? That's the conundrum of The Grand Master, which is Wong's dramatization of the life of revered martial arts master Ip Man, who lived from 1893 to 1972 and influenced generations of other artists. The Grand Master, at least the 103-minute American edit that we both saw, Adam, employs many of the formal elements of the biopic. There's voiceover narration, a lot of intertitles, and a preference for chronology. Did these elements bog Wong down, or was he able to bend the genre's rigid form to match his own mode of impressionistic cinema?
Well, you absolutely nailed it, Josh. I think that really is the key question with this movie. And I'm afraid I'm going to have to hedge a little bit because I think the answer lies somewhere right in the middle. Wong was able to infuse enough impressionistic elements to make it feel like a Wong movie. There are some truly majestic moments here, and I know we're going to touch on them. He is able to elevate the material beyond the requirements, I think, of the biopic. So ultimately, I liked and I do recommend The Grandmaster, just not enough to keep me from feeling disappointed by it. The fight scenes here, I think, are really what maintain my interest for the most part. They're really impressive. It's intriguing to watch not just fight sequences, but an entire movie constructed out of so many close-ups. I don't think I've ever seen that before. It's true that in a lot of action movies, conventional Hollywood action movies, we get that disorienting effect with close-ups. But here, it's never disorienting. And there's such a great focus on the fighters' movements, their hands, their feet, their faces as well. And it really did strike me about halfway through that this is something I've never really seen before, because the whole film, for the most part, is really constructed just on those close-ups. And I think if I watched it again, I might actually debate with myself a little more whether or not that's ultimately as effective as it should be. But it nevertheless is interesting. It's always also interesting to watch Tony Leung. He's just one of those actors who, even when he's perfectly still, I think is mesmerizing. And he is perfectly still for a lot of this movie, including somehow during the fight scenes. He really doesn't move much at all. And as I'm going on about the things I really did respond to in this film, Zhang Zi, his co-star here, his eventual love interest who starts as a rival, she's a force. Their meet cute, if you can call it that, is one of the best I've maybe ever seen in all of cinema. It's this fight scene where she's determined to restore honor to her family by defeating him because he just defeated her grandmaster father. And his condition for the fight is that if he breaks anything, if there's any damage to the room or anything in the room, he loses because he says martial arts is all about precision and control. And that attention to precision makes that scene so intense because it heightens their focus on each other and their movements. And Wong emphasizes that so effectively in the camera and the editing choices, which all combines to heighten our focus as an audience. We're watching these two characters undergo a dramatic change. They're forging a life-changing connection, all while ostensibly trying to hurt each other. So with a sequence like that, it'd be nearly impossible for me to not appreciate this movie. But to get to where I finally stand on it, I do think it's very likely, Josh, that I might appreciate the version that's 25 minutes longer a lot more. I have to wonder if I would, simply because what kept me from fully embracing the Grandmaster as much as I wanted to was its structure. I think it simply does try to cover too much ground too quickly. You mentioned the intertitles, these text bridges that help us go from one sequence to another. They fill in the gaps. Sometimes the text reveals decisions and experiences that sound more dramatic and interesting than what we just saw or are about to see. The narration sometimes comes off as a little too neat. And I just think that in trying to do service to this extraordinary life, it does just the opposite. I'm not suggesting by any stretch it needed to make the main character of Yip Man more heroic or have a more triumphant ending. But I just felt like you never truly get the full scope of his life because there's no narrative sweep. There's just a collection of moments, often thrilling and really moving moments, but a collection nevertheless.
I'm not quite as reserved in my praise, though. I'd probably agree with all of your critiques of the structure. They're certainly not doing this movie any favors. Yet I do think enough of it rises so far above that that I started to forget that they were there. And and even when those intertitles would appear, I'd almost brush them aside. They felt like commercials little bit. And I was just thinking, all right, you know, this will get out of the way in a few seconds. Then we can get back to the real movie, because this is at heart such a real movie. This good stuff is so good. And I think it all works of a piece together enough that the intertitles and the chronology and that sort of stuff does fall by the wayside. You're so right about the fight scenes, the use of close-ups, the feet especially. You mentioned feet. That's the one thing I noticed from the martial arts films I've seen before. I don't recall this much attention, not just on feet. It's not even really on feet striking. It's more on their positioning and how they're sliding and where they're holding a person so that they are in the right spot, that precision you talked about.
That's it.
And that was just so elegant to watch. And again, it's of a piece with what Wong does in so many of his films, is capture the importance of small gestures. There's a reason he uses slow motion so often, and it's not in a way you might expect, where we would see a spin in air in slow motion, something like The Matrix, perhaps, which shares an action choreographer here with Yen Ho-Ping. That's not how slow motion is used here. Instead, it's used for expressions often, or small gestures like the foot sliding back, so that we can grasp the importance of them. And I got so lost in those moments that the biopic restrictions did not bother me. And the fight scenes aren't, I've seen them talked about as being, well, they're the best parts of the movie, they make the movie worth it, which makes them sound like they're kind of dropped in here and there, and we just wait for those to come, and that's why we're there, for the fight scenes. But they're very much of a piece with the theme that is going on, at least one of these themes in the
film,
which is the transfer and wielding of power. And this happens, obviously, in the fight scenes because they're physical, and the two combatants are transferring power, balancing power, exchanging power in very physical ways. But we also see this in a lot of the ceremonial gestures, especially involving the early scenes with Gong Er. This is the character played by Zhang Zi, her father, who's played by Wong Shinshang. He is this older grandmaster who's looking for a successor. And when he visits Yip Man, it's to test him out a little bit, to give him a try, possibly as a successor. And these are some things I didn't fully understand, even with the intertitles, but that's okay, because the general gist of it, this passing on of power or authority and how these characters are going to do that, was compelling enough to me. And these two, Yip Man and the character played by Wong Xingshan, they get this great scene involving a cake. And the older man holds out a cake, and challenges him to take it without breaking it. And again, it's more like a riddle. Exactly. The particulars of the tradition I wasn't clear on, but watching these two gauge each other and test each other out and get a feel for each other was just fascinating to me.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. It is. And I think in addition to the sense of there being a transfer of power in a lot of the fight scenes, that's one way to look at it. Another way would be exactly what you just talked about there with that cake, is this notion of there being just a sense of history to every motion and every action that they have, and their legacy being important, and the fact that they're trying to unite something. That's a key thing here. It keeps coming up over and over again, the North and the South, and trying to unite their two different ways. And so when you watch a scene like that where they come together, their hands come together, you see how Gong Er and Yip Man come together ultimately in their fight scene. That really is reflected in all those sequences. For me, this is, again, both a strength of the film and then ultimately a weakness. The truth is, I could never escape the fact that Gong Er is just by far the more interesting character
completely.
In this movie. I really was left wishing that I had watched her biopic, or I could watch a film about
completely with
this
you there.
Character, because she's certainly the far more dramatic character, Josh, because she actually changes. Yip Man is this character who backs his way into everything. He's pushed to fight the Grand Master. It's not something he actually seeks and wants to do. And he ends up in Hong Kong at one point, and he has to stay there because the borders close, and they keep him there. He's a character who really is stuck a lot by history. She's not a victim of history at all. Or another way to look at it is, she's naive enough to believe that she's not a victim of history, and she's someone who can actually impose her will on it. And she tries that, and we see the harm it causes her as she does that. Either way, that's the story I was really swept up in. Think about a woman in this time and place trying to practice martial arts and the expectations there and the limitations put on her, and trying to be someone who's going to carry on to move forward with her father's legacy rather than be the one who effectively ends it. That's all really fascinating. The decisions that her character has to make and their consequences are really intense. I just felt like they were never cohesively worked in to Yip Man's progression along the way, and I really did feel like I wanted so badly to just stay with that character. And I do have to wonder, I know we're not going to dwell on it too much, but maybe those extra 25 minutes again in that Hong Kong version that I know so many critics are praising so much, maybe that allows those two sides to mesh together better. I don't know, but I do know I loved every time she was on screen and I wanted more of her.
Yeah, I don't want just 25 more minutes of her. I want, like you said, a completely different movie tracing her entire life, because it does seem to be the more compelling experience that she had, at least judging by the details we get from Yip Man here in this story. I mean, he is a little bit of watching his own action going on. And there are a couple of reasons we're more drawn to Gong Er, I think. And one is narrative, just that she has the tragic story. She has the more obstacles in front of her.
Right.
And she goes up against them in more interesting ways. So the narrative is on her side. The other thing is the acting. I'm with you that Leong, you can watch him do anything. But here he's passive.
Yeah, he's really passive.
He's bemused.
He's stoic. Bemused
and
is a word I had in my notes too.
Well,
yeah.
And the interesting thing was, I thought once tragedy does strike in his life, at least that we see, and he makes the move to Hong Kong, does that alter his demeanor much? And slightly, but not as much as you'd expect, and certainly not to a degree that you could even mark the performance had transitioned from this point to another point and drawn us through that. So it's very much a passive performance compared to Zhang Zi as Gong Er, which is just every moment you can read. And she's been like this in all of her films that I've seen of hers. You can read on her face everything going on underneath. And often there's that fire there. There's a little bit of anger and impudence as well. And all of those elements come into play with this character who, yes, I mean, it's more tragic because she's this woman who wants to continue to fight for her family's tradition, but she's disallowed because of her gender. And there's so much drama there that I wish we could have gotten more of it.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the new film from acclaimed Hong Kong director Wong Kar-wai. It's called The Grand Master. We haven't even mentioned this yet. It is ultimately a film about the man who became a legend because he trained Bruce Lee. That is really more of an afterthought in this film.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned it because the movie barely mentions it.
Yeah, that's something that does just come up at the end of the movie. And I think just to put a cap on what we're talking about here with the Gong Er character and some of those fight scenes and the drama there, I go back to my favorite word, stakes. The stakes of her fight scenes are always incredibly high, including one of the real set pieces in this film that I did love. She's fighting a character. I won't get into too many details, but to say she's trying to reclaim her family's legacy. And she has made, again, some decisions along the way that mean she really has no choice but to win. She has to win. And so the whole time she's fighting, you're thinking about those consequences and you're thinking about those choices that she's made. Every time Yip Man fights, they're thrilling to watch, but there doesn't seem to be much at stake. It doesn't seem to be a case where his life is going to change dramatically either way. And maybe that is something that we're not appreciating enough about that character. Maybe that's ultimately what should be fascinating about this film, is watching this character sort of go through history on this even keel almost and be a victim of it in a sense, as I suggested. I don't know, but all I can say is I was definitely more drawn to that character in those scenes.
I think it's because they're in opposition to each other. So we should and probably would appreciate a film entirely about Yip Man's experiences testing his style of martial arts against, really every one of his fight scenes is against someone who is coming from a different tradition. And they're kind of testing each other's technique and seeing which one will win out, or not even win out. It's more of just encountering and learning from each other in a lot of ways.
Right.
And I think that could make for a film that has plenty of drama to trace that journey. But when you do put it up against a story that has, as you say, higher stakes, it's not going to win out for sure.
No. And that question, too, about legacy, or that issue of legacy we brought up, that was a key line for me, and something I really tapped into at one point and responded to, was where I believe it's the Gong Er character who says to the man who was supposed to be the successor to her father, but has shamed them and actually the entire country by being a traitor. She says, I have to get my legacy back. She says something about returning the legacy. And you just think about, Josh, something like that. The notion of a legacy, something so intangible, being something that you can give back or reclaim anyway. And you contrast that with what's going on in this film. It's super tangible, right? The hands, the feet, bodies colliding. You can't get more tangible than that. And then you're comparing that against these things that are as ungraspable as history, as legacy, as honor, as love, ultimately, as well. That juxtaposition was something that really did carry me throughout this whole movie. And I talked about the close-ups. I actually think, and I could be misremembering this, even though I did make a note of it, because I did see this movie 2 weeks ago, but there's a point where we really see in those fight scenes with Gong Er and some of those more high-stakes sequences, the camera opens up. We finally do get some more wide shots. We get to contextualize her a little bit more within her surroundings, and I think that's something that also made me more interested in watching her, whereas the lasting image from this film of Yip Man, beyond any of the moves he pulls off, is Tony Leung's bemused face. That really is the key thing. Instantly, when you think of him, I think that's what you probably go to in your head.
Some of those wide shots are just beautiful compositions in the form of tableaus, really. I mean, we get some that are actual still photos of Yip Man with his students or with his family. But what was so gorgeous to me were some of the live action tableaus. So when you have Yip Man meeting Gong Er for a banquet, they sit in front of this lush table surrounded by, again, decor, and costumes come into play, and they're almost frozen. It almost looks like it's a still frame. It might be. It feels to me like they're part of this live stage drama that has paused just before the curtain drops, and you get this moment to savor all the details. And the other interesting thing about a lot of those shots, and why, again, it brings to mind the idea of ceremony to me, is that there's always some sort of spectating audience. There are spectators around, whether they're other martial arts students who are watching, or in the case, some of these fights take place in a brothel. And so you have the women working at the brothel who are at different stairway levels watching. And it all just presents this really rich tableau that Wong is bringing to what are being called just fight scenes, but there's so much more going on.
Well, you as well talked about how in his films, every gesture seems to matter. And that was something that really did occur to me watching this movie as well, the sensory nature of this movie. And maybe it's because of the close-ups, how close we are watching those faces on screen. But every sound in this movie matters. Every movement matters. And I do love being in a world like that, where you're watching a film and watching characters, whether it's in these fight sequences or even in a conversation, where just the sort of changing of their breath actually tells you something about their character. You don't get that very often.
No.
Certainly not in a lot of Hollywood movies. You do get it very often with Wong Kar-wai. That's The Grandmaster. It's out now in limited release. If you've seen it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. Or you can find us on Twitter, @filmspotting, and over at facebook.com/filmspotting. I do want to note, Josh, that if you haven't yet seen The Grandmaster and you're curious and you are planning to see it, and maybe you're inclined to want to see the longer version, I found that every website I go to check movie listings, they all list the time of The Grandmaster is 2 hours 10 minutes.
Really?
Yeah, every one. Fandango, doesn't matter what I go to, it says 2
that's
hours 10
confusing.
Minutes. And that's not the case. It's not the 2 hour 10 minute version unless there's something unique to the town that you live in and your movie theaters. But everywhere I've seen, they're playing the U.S. version. It's about 105, 108 minutes, not the 2 hour 10 minute version. So just a little bit of a warning there.
Well, that was a fairly pleasant conversation, but it's nothing but peace, love, and understanding next with Massacre Theater. Plus, our Korean Auteurs Marathon kicks off with a review of Kim Ki-duk's Three Iron. Stay with us.
I'm a man. That's what you raised me to be. I'm not an identity crisis. This was planned. I'm a man. This innocence and
Hey folks, just a quick reminder that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by our partner Shutterstock.com. At Shutterstock, you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project. Inspired by The Grandmaster, Josh, I went to Shutterstock.com, typed in Kung Fu, wanted to see what they might have in relation to Kung Fu there, whether it's photos or video. I found 131 pieces of stock footage available relating to Kung Fu, including 110 of them in HD. So basically, whatever you're looking for, you're bound to find it there at Shutterstock.com.
It'll be great for your website, advertisement, multimedia presentation, any other type of film project you might have. There are over 1 million high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations, and 3D motion graphics. They also have clips in a variety of digital formats. Most do come in HD. Shutterstock also has sophisticated search tools so that you can drill down by category, clip resolution, contributor name, and more. And they've also partnered with Facebook to provide advertising customers free access to all the images through Facebook's ad creation tool. This is a great resource for local businesses that want professional-looking ads.
That sounds like a great initiative, something brand new from Shutterstock. They also offer flexible pricing, so you can buy individual clips or get them in video packs. You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. There's no credit card needed. Just start your account, begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next creative project could be like, and save your video selection to your clip box. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code FILM9 and new accounts will receive 25% off any package. Again, that's Shutterstock.com, and for 25% off new accounts, just use offer code FILM9. We thank Shutterstock for their support of Film Spotting.
Do you mind if I ask you a personal question?
No, not at all.
Well, forgive me for being so inquisitive. But during the past few weeks, I've wondered whether you might be having some second thoughts about the mission.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. With Josh Larson, I'm Adam Kempinar. That was Douglas Rain as the memorable voice of HAL 9000 and Cair Dullea as Dr. Dave Bowman, of course, from Stanley Kubrick's masterpiece, 2001, A Space Odyssey. We actually have concerns about our own mission here on the show. Next week, we are planning a Film Spotting Sacred Cow review of 2001, A Space Odyssey from 1968. It was a movie voted on by our listeners. It was picked to be the next Sacred Cow. As much as I tried to fight it, Josh, as much as I feared this would happen, it's upon us.
You're really worried about this, aren't you?
I am. I mean, how many films are more imposing and intimidating than 2001 A Space Odyssey?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I'm going into it with an appreciation for it, so maybe I feel a little more comfortable, but I'm also willing to let that opinion change because it's been a while since I've seen it.
Well, we're going to see how comfortable our listeners are with 2001 A Space Odyssey as we get to our poll question this week. We're going to find out what you really think of Kubrick's bewildering masterpiece, and we promise we will not let Hal know. That's coming up a bit later in the segment. Right now, though, it's time for Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Adam and I massacred this.
I've always said that God can kiss my ass, but I just changed my lifetime tune about 30 minutes ago. Because I know that whatever is out there trying to get in is pure evil straight from hell. And if there is a hell, and those sons of bitches are from it, then there has got to be a heaven, Jacob. There's got to be. So which are you? Are you a faithless preacher? Or are you a mean motherfucking servant of God?
I'm a mean servant.
That was George Clooney as Seth Gecko and Harvey Keitel as Jacob Fuller in 1996's From Dusk Till Dawn, written by Quentin Tarantino and directed by Robert Rodriguez.
We knew there would be a lot of tie-ins and a lot of potential tie-ins. Wow, did our listeners outdo themselves this week. Tom Robertson in Burwood, Australia, wrote in, Josh, with 10 connections to last week's show. We will say right off the bat, we did not come up with those 10 connections on our own. We were thinking maybe of two or three, but I'll give you four of them here. Tarantino was the director of Jackie Brown, a film listed in your Tribute to Elmore Leonard top five. The World's End, the movie we reviewed, is a film that starts as a very grounded drama and turns into a genre film halfway through, much like how From Dusk Till Dawn starts as a crime film that becomes a horror film. The main characters in both World's End and From Dusk Till Dawn are a group, with some more willing than others to go to their destination, and a bar or bars play a key role in both films. Again, that's just four of Tom's 10.
Nice work, Tom. But Nathan Saranofsky from Knoxville, Tennessee, he had 11 tie-ins, including eight that Tom didn't even mention. I'm going to just give you three here. Most of the action takes place over a single evening, he said, has main characters that are decked out in all black, and both have external forces that cause characters to address their internal struggles. So vampires equals lost faith, and the robot aliens equal the fear of growing up and losing one's individuality.
So depending on how much you mince words there, you've got essentially at least 18 different connections. And Josh, neither Tom nor Nathan mentioned the George Clooney connection, the fact that he's in Out of Sight. Jack Foley
right.
was an honorable mention for me in the Elmore Leonard top five. And Harvey Keitel plays himself in the final scene of Get Shorty, another Elmore Leonard connection. So that might be the most connections in the history of Master
Theater.
Yeah,
probably.
Thank you to everyone who wrote in with your comments, though I don't know why I'm thanking every listener, because we do have Eric Grebner in Decatur who said, Josh did a respectable Clooney, but Adam, how dare you muck up Harvey Keitel's self-censoring creature? It's I thought Master P had joined the film spotting crew for a week. Well,
that's good.
I think we all went through a Master P phase, but I really bristle at that, Josh, because this notion that I should somehow be tethered to the words on a page or what someone did before me with a performance, I can take it in whatever direction I want.
Yeah, but
I reinterpreted the scene.
That was just that was like James Brown in slow motion or something. I didn't know where you were going with that.
James Brown in slow motion.
It didn't work.
That's a good band name, or at least a good album name. I like it. If you want to hear my James Brown in slow motion take on Harvey Keitel, or our discussion of The World's End, or our top five Elmore Leonard characters, you could do that by going to filmspotting.net or finding the show in iTunes. We did get a lot of entries this week, Josh, though. Once again, not a record. We're still a long ways from being in the top 10. Why don't you reach into the hat and pick out this week's winner?
The winner is Brian McCarthy from Agawam, Massachusetts.
Congratulations, Brian. Email feedback at filmspotting.net for your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
Camera, mite. Camera, mesen de. Yukkuri to. Ne, passion. Camera, meni wa.
My side.
Passion da yo. Wakatta?
And with intensity.
Is that everything? I mean, it seemed like he said quite a bit more than that.
Can't wait to see what interpretive spin Adam is going to put on his character this week for Massacre Theater. It's presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information is available at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
New on Fandor this week with Telluride going on. I know that's a film festival a lot of our listeners are paying attention to, want to see the reviews coming out of that fest of some of the bigger movies. Maybe some of our listeners are at Telluride and are taking in some of those movies. they're actually shining the spotlight on some past Telluride films over at Fandor.com this week. So a lot of great stuff to check out, as always, over there at Fandor. We do get to this week's scene, and Josh, we haven't decided which character we're playing here. Let's go ahead and just do this on air. Which world
flip a coin?
Want? Yeah, we could flip a coin.
Let's flip a coin.
That sounds like great radio.
It'll only take a couple of minutes.
Why don't you go ahead and take the lead role in the scene?
Is that who goes first, do you
no,
think?
No, that's who goes second,
oh.
I think.
Okay.
Well,
all right.
It's
yeah,
the
yeah,
lead
that's fine.
Role in the movie.
That's
so
fine.
Why don't you go ahead and take it?
I just gave him a clue.
Yeah, that's true. We did. We'll also give you another clue that we did change the names. I don't know if that's actually a hint at all. We're making it tougher on you because if we did use the characters' names, well, there'd be no point in even having the competition because it would be insanely obvious. So with that said, are you ready?
I'm ready. I'm going to give you the action if you're starting it off. And action. Try acid. It's guaranteed.
Shit, man. On my last trip was a real bummer, man.
I never had a bummer on acid.
No, I'm trying naturally high now.
Yeah, whatever works. Making movies at MGM yet?
Yeah, got in to see the head of production over there. He said, "Where's your script?" And I said, "I don't need a script. Godard doesn't use a script. He improvises with his camera. Guy says, great. Who's Godard?"
I'm off movies, man. Went out to the desert, got lost. Been living up on Trick's rooftop. Got stuck on a chick.
And scene.
Scene.
I don't know, Josh. It sounded like you were going a little method with that one.
Oh, yeah.
Were you recalling past experiences
no.
there with that scene?
All made up, man.
Uh-huh. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. The deadline is Monday, September 9th.
Winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
People came to Face Mash in a stampede, right?
Yeah.
But it wasn't because they saw pictures of hot girls. You can go anywhere on the internet and see pictures of hot girls.
Yeah.
It was because they saw pictures of girls that they knew. People want to go on the internet and check out their friends, so why not build a website that offers that? Friends, pictures, profiles, whatever you can visit, browse around. Maybe it's someone you just met at a party. But I'm not talking about a dating site. I'm talking about taking the entire social experience of college and putting it online.
I can't feel my legs.
I know. I'm totally psyched about this too, but Wardo.
Yeah.
It would be exclusive.
You would have to know the people on the site to get past your own page, like getting punched.
Well, that's good.
Wardo, it's like a final club, except we're the president.
Mark Zuckerberg there wreaking havoc on the film spotting poll as we get to the results for our question last week, as we were anticipating, Josh, our discussion of The Grandmaster, the film from Wong Kar-wai about Yip Man. And this notion of what makes a biopic really comes to a head when you think about a movie like The Social Network, which you just heard a scene from, the movie from David Fincher. Many of our listeners did question whether or not it belonged in a biopic poll question. And that's a legitimate complaint. I think it's something I did consider as we were putting the question together, that it doesn't seem as similar to some of the other nominees there in the poll.
Yeah, I understand what they're getting at. But at the same time, you'd almost have to say something similar about Lincoln, too, which is definitely a biopic.
It's so focused.
It has this concentrated period of a person's life. So I think both do count as biopics.
I agree. That's why we included it in our question, which was, which of these films made by a contemporary of Wong Kar-wai is your favorite? So all these directors were born roughly in the 50s, started making movies in the 80s. Your choices were An Angel at My Table or Bright Star from director Jane Campion. So you had two there you could go with, either the story of the New Zealand writer Janet Frame or the movie Bright Star about John Keats and Fanny Braun. You could go with Carlos from director Olivier Assayas, the movie about the terrorist Carlos the Jackal, or Che, the movie from Steven Soderbergh about the man the stadium, Che Stadium, was named after. Actually,
is that what it
actually
is?
No, Che Guevara. I'm Not There from director Todd Haynes, his odd movie, but one I enjoy quite a bit about Bob Dylan. We also gave you Malcolm X, the movie from Spike Lee as an option, or Milk, Gus Van Zandt's story about the assassinated gay rights activist. Or finally, you could go with The Social Network from David Fincher, the movie about Mark Zuckerberg and the building of Facebook. Josh, how did it come out?
A paltry 1%. Voted for Che. Could that be because maybe you and I are the only ones who saw Che? Have you seen Che?
Yeah, actually, okay. I interviewed Soderbergh for the movie Che, so it was discussed here on the show. That's a little bit of a mistake, though. I think it might have gotten a few more votes, Josh. I forgot to put Che in the poll question.
What?
For about 3 days.
What?
Yeah. It missed out on 3 days of votes.
The things we learned.
This whole question is invalid.
Anyways, I'll still try to proceed here. Jane Campion didn't fare well, even though we gave two films to include with her. 5% voted for An Angel at My Table or Bright Star. 8% voted for Carlos. 10% voted for I'm Not There. 11% for Malcolm X. So at the top, we have 15% of the vote going to Milk, meaning the winner was Social Network, 52%.
Wow, 52%. Charles Coates says, The Social Network by a long shot, Sorkin's dialogue, Reznor's soundtrack, and Fincher's cold hand for digital video create a dark, rainy film noir version of Harvard's Halls. I love how this movie refuses to be a biopic, but a timeless tale of betrayal. And yes, as we noted, there were a lot of commenters like Jeremy in Colorado and Jeremy, quote, in transit, who questioned The Social Network status as a biopic, saying, you know, it's a historical drama or it's just too limited. But as you said, Josh, there are a lot of biopics that I think people regard as biopics that do tend to focus on just a small portion of one character's life. They are choosing to focus on that portion because it's what ultimately comes to define that character. They're the reason why that movie's being made. So it works for me, though I do agree it is a little bit different than a lot of our other choices. We also heard from Nicole.
She wonders if The Social Network is getting so many votes just because most people haven't seen the others. Or maybe it's just because Adam put The Social Network in the poll a few days before all the others. That didn't happen? Okay,
no.
Just want to check. Nicole goes on, I've never quite understood why The Social Network gets so much love. It's a fine movie, but I'm Not There is a truly innovative piece of filmmaking that displays the genius of both the writer, director, and the subject. Film spotting listeners, watch I'm Not There. It will change you.
Peter R. says, I'd probably opt for Carlos from the list. Asayas deftly unravels the mystery surrounding the reprehensible international terrorist, who is partially responsible for unleashing terrorism as a means of exerting political power on the world. Visually, it's a stunner. The soundtrack is also amazing.
Here's a vote for Campion. It comes from Cleo in the Rock Mountains. I chose An Angel at My Table because it's the most intimate. I feel that the other films explore external ideas and phenomena and events through the protagonist's experiences, and Campion expresses the person and the character with a nearly unsettling clarity and proximity through the chaos of events in her life.
Yeah, I do think what hurt Campion a little bit, despite having two options there, is I think both of those movies are underseen. I have seen Bright Star, and I like the movie. I'm also a big fan of John Keats, but An Angel at My Table is one I still need to see. So that hurt Campion a little bit probably here. Some alternate choices. This comes from VV, None of the Above. Biopics tend to be one-time viewing for me, with one exception, Ed Wood, Tim Burton's best movie and my favorite biopic. I think Burton probably could have fit into contemporary scheme here. That is a great pick.
We also heard from Aaron Teachman in Washington, D.C. I'm not sure how the filmmaker fits in with your Wong Kar-wai contemporary criterion, but my absolute favorite biopic of recent years was Stephen Frears' The Queen. And I'm curious why it didn't make the list, assuming there is a reason other than Sam's heavy hand.
Actually, Sam's heavy hand is to blame for everything on this
show.
It also should get the credit for everything that's good about this show. But I don't know. We just didn't consider The Queen. I think Frears probably does without looking up his vitals. I think he probably does.
Sounds about right, yeah.
There as well. And
also a very
good
movie.
Yeah, we're on the same page there. So there were a lot of options you could go with, and we did feel like we had to restrict it to five or six of our favorites. And that brings us to this week's poll question. As we suggested earlier in the segment, we're going to be discussing 2001 A Space Odyssey next week on the show. Michael Phillips, the revered Michael Phillips, will be here to hold our hand through that discussion, hopefully guide me through it a little bit and share some of his insights. So that got us thinking about the movie. Josh, you talked about how you come from a real place of appreciation with that film. I appreciate it as well, but there are different levels and different types of appreciation. We want to know how much our listeners appreciate it. The question is, 2001 A Space Odyssey is a masterpiece, ..
that I genuinely love, that I find mystifying, a masterpiece to others. I think it's overrated. That film spotting confession, I need to see.
So, Josh, you're voting on this one that you genuinely love, I'm taking it?
Yeah, I have to go there now. But the caveat here is the last time I saw it was in college. It was at the Cinerama Dome in L.A. Just pristine experience. So I'm perfectly willing to revisit it and say maybe this thing is a little overrated because I know there's a contingent out there that feels that way.
I think you also probably went with some of the characters from our massacre theater scene. To go take in the experience at the Cinerama.
And I'm not holding Michael's hand either when he's here. So,
well, I'm going with it's a masterpiece that I find mystifying because it's a movie like you, Josh. I watched it back in college, but I didn't have that experience. I watched it in my dorm room on a little like 14-inch television, which I don't think is the most proper way to take it in.
It was mystifying because you were squinting the whole time.
I was fascinated by it. That's true. And I can certainly appreciate the craft of it. I don't know that it's a film that I have any sense of really understanding what Kubrick is trying to say. And That was a long time ago now, unfortunately, college. I think it was my freshman year in college. So that was a while back. I really am, actually, as much as I hate our listeners for voting for it, I'm relishing the opportunity to see it again, to watch it on a little bit of a bigger screen. I'm still going to have to watch it at my house, but on a better television set in Blu-ray. And we'll see what experience I have this time. We want to know what you think of 2001. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. Also at filmspotting.net, that is, of course, where you can get information about our bonus content we bring to you here every week, a little extra bit of audio. It's available to our app users. If you have the Film Spotting app for iPhone, Android, or the Windows 8 phone, we're going to share a little bit of feedback on our recent review of Elysium. I love it, too, because it's an all-negative edition.
Come on.
I should say, Josh, it wasn't just a case of me picking only negative emails that I had to go out of my way for. We only got a handful of responses, and they were all pretty mixed on the movie, so there weren't a lot of people there
know.
To defend you.
After your poll confession, I'm suspicious of all sorts of shenanigans going on behind the scenes.
Pure accident. I like the movie Che. I like both parts of Che. I wanted to see that do better, so... Don't pin that on me, sir. Sarah and Madison and Paul in San Francisco both have thoughts on Elysium. We'll get to in our bonus content some good stuff there. We'll also get to part two, the Before Sunset, if you will, in our trilogy of feedback on the movie Before Midnight. Again, if you want to seek that out, go to filmspotting.net and click on apps. It is time as well, Josh, for something we haven't had to do in a long time. I'm not saying we haven't gotten things wrong, but they've been maybe a little more minor, or listeners just haven't caught them, or we caught them in time and cut them out of the show. But man, I've been on a roll lately with some mistakes, so I want to acknowledge them here during our discussion of films about nature. Top five nature movies, as an honorable mention, or actually more of a film spotting confession, I said that I really wanted to see the movie Walkabout, and I said it was an Agnes Varda film. It's, of course, a Nicholas Roeg film. For some reason, I had Vagabond in my head, which is an Agnes Varda film I've seen, and I was picturing that cover when I mentioned Walkabout, and I just misspoke. Speaking of misspeaking, I also did say on our recent Elmore Leonard tribute show that Anne Margaret was Feathers in Rio Bravo. Of course, Angie Dickinson was Feathers there opposite John Wayne in Rio Bravo. Give me some credit. They look a lot alike.
Yeah, and also Anne Margaret in 52 Pickups. So
the Elmore Leonard movie, which I just watched the night before, opposite Roy Scheider. So Anne Margaret,
I can see that
on my brain. But what I love here, Josh, as I confess to getting these wrong, and it's always me. It's always me who has the mistakes. I'm always talking too fast, not thinking straight, and you never catch any of them.
No.
You just let me say them. You never call me out on them.
Does that mean they're half my mistakes?
Well,
does that mean I'm just not listening when you're talking?
If you want to look at it that way, Josh, you can bear that burden. It turns out you also recently made a mistake.
Why didn't you catch this one?
Well, there's a good reason why I didn't catch it, which everyone will know as we read the email from Ben Slabach in Cincinnati, Ohio. It pains me to inform you that upon listening to your top five dangerous missions today, that was a recent top five tying in with Elysium, I noticed that one of Josh's honorable mentions was Return of the King. Unfortunately, he said it was Bilbo's mission to destroy the ring. It's actually Frodo, not Bilbo. Bilbo is the main character in the most recent The Hobbit. A true fan of Tolkien's work would know this. For this mistake, I think Josh should be cast to the fire of Mount Doom.
You know what my problem is? I think all hobbits look alike.
That's even worse. You're just digging a bigger hole, and I'm really shocked that we only heard from two or three listeners on that, Josh. I thought maybe more people would catch it. I'm certainly not going to catch any mistakes that have to do with the Lord of the Rings series.
You're no help there.
No, I'm no help there. We do appreciate you calling us out on our airs. We regret every single one of them. You can email us feedback anytime about the show. Hopefully it's mostly positive, not all the little mistakes you catch. Feedback at filmspotting.net. It's always tough selecting a transition clip from a foreign language film. It's even tougher when that foreign language film has virtually no dialogue. So that was the sound of a character doing a little laundry from the first film in our Korean auteurs marathon, 2004's Three Iron.
We really should have picked a golf swing.
Yeah.
A thwack.
I thought about that, but it's going to pay off later, maybe. Over the next couple months, we'll watch and discuss five more movies, all from the past decade, directed by prominent Korean filmmakers, filling in some holes in our cinematic educations. Hopefully many of you will follow along, get rid of some of your blind spots as well, or if you're already well-versed in the work of these directors, you can just listen and mock us as we reach for pseudo-intellectual insights. I am, Josh, familiar with a few of the directors we're covering in this marathon, but I was totally ignorant about writer-director Kim Ki-duk. So after seeing Three Iron, by my count, the 11th of his 19 credits to date, and writing out my notes, I went to get a little bit of background. where I read about terrible scenes of animal cruelty in his 2000 release, The Isle, and about his latest movie, playing out of competition at Venice, called Mobius, a story that, according to Variety, involves a fight over the husband's infidelity ending in the woman dismembering her son. Kim made serious edits to Mobius to ensure a theatrical release after it failed two of the Korean ratings board's 7 tests of decency.
Yikes.
Only two, though. I mean, come on, only two, in fairness. There's also this Rotten Tomatoes blurb from then-LA Weekly critic Scott Foundas. As repellent and repellently opportunistic a piece of work as the various shock horror provocations that helped to launch Keeduck's worrisome career. The movie he's referring to there is, in fact, the movie we're about to discuss, Three Iron, which I think could safely be called a love story, albeit an odd one, about the relationship between a drifter, Tess Suk, and an abused wife, Sun Hwa, who meet after Tess Suk sneaks into her home and goes about making himself cozy, preparing some food, having a bath, fixing broken appliances, and, oh yeah, washing her clothes. This is all routine for Tess Suk, who we watch go about his nomadic and criminal, yet somehow sweet and innocent existence with Sun Hwa along for the ride on the back of his motorcycle. Josh, did you see an offbeat but potentially endearing romance, or the same film Mr. Foundas saw, where you repelled it all by the subject matter or style of Three Iron, and despite the potentially disturbing nature of apparently most of his other films, are you inclined to see more of Kim's work?
That's really surprising that the word repellent would be used to describe. It certainly seems to fit his other films, which I haven't seen either, but I had the same experience. After watching Three Iron, I did a little research and found out all of these awful things the man had previously filmed, and it didn't match up with Three Iron at all, at least to me. It is endearing. It very much, I'm going to use Western associations here, which probably aren't appropriate, but to me it felt like a Goldilocks and the Three Bears story that was mixed somehow with a ghost story, very much had the air of a fable to me.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, with the lack of dialogue, the two leads don't speak at all. I think Sun Yun Lee, as the female lead, does get a few lines at the very end, but that's it. As far as the two of them connecting, it's completely silent. So there, I had the feel of silent cinema. There's a lot of pantomiming here.
For sure.
And gestures, again, come into play. And so it did have this gentle feel to it. Then it takes this twist at the end that feels a little bit like a ghost story.
Yeah, it becomes really metaphysical.
Very metaphysical. And Tess Suk's character becomes this figure who he does end up in jail, we can say, because of this nomadic existence he has of breaking into people's homes. And there he almost transforms, though we see him training himself to be able to move more silently and become undetected. He really almost transforms into this spirit. And yet here things don't even really get creepy or disturbing. It's played romantically. And so throughout, I found the film, and pleasant isn't probably the right word, but compared to some of the plot summaries of Kim Ki-duk's other movies, pleasant probably does fit.
Yeah, I was really surprised as well to read that response from Scott Foundas, because when I watched the movie, I found it to be so warm-hearted. I found there to be so much humanity to this movie. Now, there are some twisted moments. When you read a comment like that and you go back and rethink some scenes in the movie, you realize that there are moments of sadistic pleasure that some characters take. There's also a little bit of masochistic pleasure where a character is having pain inflicted on him and seems to be smiling about it. So there are those elements. But again, this overflowing sense of humanity to this movie, specifically how I mean humanity here in the sense that his actions, as you watch this film unfold, even as he's breaking into these people's homes, his actions are almost always benefiting others.
Right.
He's always doing something in the service of the people who live there. And there is a real selflessness to that character that I think it's hard not to respond to favorably. I think that humanity is also reinforced by the fact that, as we've touched on, there's almost no talking to this film. It's all physical. It's all action. It reinforces this notion that what you do matters more than what you say. And compare that to a character like the husband, who we haven't mentioned, but we talked about Sun Hwa, who's this abused wife. The husband there, who is abusing her, he says all the right things. He tells her how much he loves her and how much he cares about her and wants her back and all this stuff, but he's constantly hurting her. So there's that juxtaposition there of his words and deeds. You mentioned that they don't talk to each other except maybe a few lines. I think her only line at the end of the film is, "I love you." So this whole idea that when she finally does open her mouth, the only thing she says is something actually we've seen her show physically in her actions throughout the whole movie, I think is really powerful. And there are open questions. There are a lot of open questions in this movie, some I wish I had answers to or better answers to. For example, you have to wonder, did she talk before? Is she only going silent because she knows that's how she's going to relate best to him, that seems to be the way he wants to interact. Those are the terms of their relationship. Or is she someone who, up until that moment, has kind of been mute and has only moved to talk at the end of the movie? We don't really know, and I don't think it really matters in some of those questions. As I said, I think they're the kind of ambiguous questions I actually really like in a movie.
And it also lends this romanticism to that central section where the two of them are going from home to home. It's interesting to watch them form these domestic rituals
right. That
are not filled with chatter. And so everything they do, whether it's make a meal for each other, just little things seem to carry so much importance then. And
right. Yeah,
it's really affecting. But you're right. It's hard to get a grasp on it, to the point where near the end, his character, Tesuk's character, becomes he's very beneficial when he goes to these houses. He's like, if someone came home after he had been there, they would feel like this beneficent spirit had come down and tidied up a little bit and thought, oh, well, I don't remember doing the laundry, but great. And then as that proceeds, though, we start to wonder, towards the end, do you think there's a possibility he may not even really exist?
Those are my questions. I have that same question written down. Is he really a ghost? I don't know.
A ghost, is he something that Sun Hua created in order to endure this existence that
right. She
has? All of these things.
Or did he die along the way? Did he undergo some kind of transformation? We don't know.
That can very much be a possibility because you mentioned the violence.
Yeah.
And there's a repeated scene. He's the victim. He's also the perpetrator in some instances. This is where the film's title comes from, of golf balls being hit at close range.
They're really good shots.
They're really good shots. And hey, I know it would be painful. I mean, I believe people have been killed, but you do wonder, you know, they get hit and they crumple over and
yeah. Then
they proceed to get hit. And it's kind of almost laughable, some of these scenes.
I agree.
And it did make sense, though, when I did a little research otherwise, to find out that right around this time was when golf was just exploding in Korea, because Korean players, women players in particular, had gained worldwide fame in tournaments. And so that does make sense that golf is such a strong thread throughout this movie, because just watching it at first, I was a little puzzled about that.
Well, I think you can't help but watch this film and think about the title, though the original Korean title really means empty house,
which
makes
much
a lot more
fitting
sense than three iron. But the fact is, this three iron club plays a key role
quite a bit,
and you can't help but see how much it's employed and wonder what exactly he might be trying to suggest there. And the only thing I could think of, though it seems too incredibly on the nose, is of all the sports, golf might be the one that most relies on repetition in order to become good at it. It really is just a matter of stroke after stroke after stroke after stroke in order to master that. And you mentioned the word ritual. That's one of the things I really love watching in this film, the way these characters go about these rituals and the way Kim Ki-duk's camera shows those rituals, because there starts to be this wonderful symmetry to what's happening on screen and what his camera is doing. Where, for example, whenever someone comes home and they have to escape, it cuts to this window shot and you see his motorcycle and you see the car pull up, and it's the same shot virtually every time. There's a lot of repetition like that in what the camera is doing, what the editing's doing. There's even some great symmetry, Josh. I wonder if this is something that struck you, or maybe I'm reaching too far here, but when he meets Sun Hua, she's been beaten by her husband and he's just left the house, and one side of her face is completely mashed in, black eyes and bruises. And then a short time later in this movie,
he gets beat
very
up. Intentional.
And it's another side of his face. And so there seems to be that symmetry where it's suggesting, okay, you know what? They're so linked in a way that if she's beaten, he's going to get beaten too. And they match each other that way. I think where I really fell under the spell of this movie, though, is that point, Josh, where you said things start to get a little out there and they do get metaphysical. It's a scene where he has been put in jail and the camera completely changes its gaze, where it goes from being our gaze watching him in the jail cell to actually reflecting his point of view. It seems to be a case where the camera takes on his persona.
Very much so, yeah.
And what stuck out to me, Josh, and you know, with a movie like this that is ambiguous enough and leaves a lot open to discussion, this is just where I'm going with it, and I wonder if listeners who saw Three Iron think I'm crazy or saw anything similar. But when that camera takes over his point of view, there's also specifically a mention of the fact that as he's shadowing one of the jailers, the jailer is in his cell and he can't find him. Well, he's right behind him. And he says, you know, you can't see anything behind you. you only see 180 degrees. Well, of course, intro film analysis goes back to the 180 degree rules. You're watching a movie and you recognize that that's all the camera shows you, and you can break that access, and then you get discontinuity and all sorts of other things. Ozu is one of the filmmakers who's the master of breaking that kind of 180 degree rule. So right away, something does flash in my mind where you start to think about the fact that the camera then and his gaze, it's almost as if maybe Kim Ki-duk is trying to suggest this whole movie and this character specifically as a metaphor for the cinematic experience. I wonder if we're supposed to see him almost as a stand-in for us, that this whole notion of him going into these homes and he eats their food and washes their clothes and sort of takes on their personas or becomes part of their lives in a way, it did make me think about whether or not he was trying to suggest that's what we do. When we go to the movies, it's a sense of us not just sort of putting on their shoes, but yes, actually kind of washing their clothes. We become part of these lives. We get to become voyeurs. And that is really reflected, Josh, through the last 20 minutes or so of this film, where we actually don't see that character again until the very end. We only see him as reflected by the camera's gaze. It's his point of view, and he is a voyeur as he keeps going into these homes that they've visited. And it just made me think that we're supposed to be the ones who are hyper aware of ourselves as we watch these characters and what they're doing. And think about all the visual motifs that come up in this film. At one of the homes has a big picture of the husband as a boxer, and he cuts out their eyes. And he's constantly taking pictures of himself. He's doing these selfies where he puts them into their frames. And it's sort of like him trying to ingratiate himself or put himself into their lives. He is acting out these scenes in a way, or creating these scenes, and he's putting himself in their movies, if you will. That's something that I actually really did start to become fascinated by, and I love everything about the last 30 minutes of this film, and I liked everything up until that as well, but that's where it really got me.
It's certainly possible, as the camera does adopt this gaze, that that's what he's going for. For me, though, I read it more as just trying to capture this disembodied state.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost less that we were becoming him or he was becoming us, that he was leaving that reality, that world, in a sense. And so I guess if I was going to stretch for something, I'd probably lean more towards the he had always been in Sun Hua's imagination as some sort of coping mechanism. And here is where we get not necessarily the reveal, but another way to use the camera to express that in the ending.
Sure.
And the ending,
I think it
did,
could be either. You're right.
Well, it's a very open film. That's, I mean, you could really apply just about anything to it and find evidence, which is thrilling to watch a movie like that often. I will say that in this case, it left it a little harder for me to fully embrace as an experience. I think a defining characteristic for this film is probably evanescence. So it has this sensibility that it can slip through your fingers very easily. And that lends romanticism a little bit too. But for me also, it was a little hard to grasp onto, and maybe is why I didn't have quite as strong of a reaction to it as you did.
Yeah, I do think as well, you touched on how there's almost this fable-like quality to it. The first time some characters come home and catch them, they actually do catch them in their bed. I mean, I'm thinking of Goldilocks, right? Who's sleeping in my bed?
Yeah,
you wonder if
yeah.
he is deliberately trying to invoke that. You also mentioned the silent cinema. Maybe there is something deliberate to that where, again, it's about actions, it's about physicality, but it is recalling specifically a former type of cinema and maybe trying to get us in that mode as we watch the story unfold. I will say that there was one scene in particular that did bother me in the way maybe Scott found us. I couldn't find his entire review. Maybe it was something that he was mentioning or getting at as well. There's a scene where he causes someone some pain inadvertently, but the way
that
the scene
very
plays
odd scene.
Out, it's very odd because this woman is hurt really badly. The way the scene ends is almost as if she might die, is
oh,
the
yeah.
sense you
yeah.
get watching it, that she is really damaged. And the follow-up to that is we see him very upset and crying about it. But then that's it, Josh. And then the next scene is actually the first big sort of romantic encounter they have. It's not a big love scene, but they actually, I think, for the first time kind of touch each other. They sit down at a table together and have this domestic scene. Very hard for me in that moment to take in this domestic tranquility and see this romantic scene play out 5 minutes after watching him, accidental or not, almost kill somebody.
I think the accident scene was there to bridge them together, to bring them together, to have that shared sense of sympathy, because it goes back to the bruise you were talking about, where she had the bruise when they first encountered. He, in this scene, just received the bruise. So my problem with having that accident sequence is that they were already, she was already comforting him because he had been bruised. So that narrative step had been made. It didn't seem to be necessary to have this other thing to get him all broken up. So it was a very strange thing that also involves the golf club.
More potential fuel to my movie metaphor idea is just the last tagline we get at the end of the movie. There's something very specifically referenced about whether or not it's all a reality or a dream. And I think that's a sense we all get kind of when we go to the movies. I think a lot of movies really deal with that question as well. So that's Three Iron. It is the first film in our Korean auteurs marathon. The second movie is Woman on the Beach, and it will be discussed in 2 weeks here on the show. So you have some time to catch up. If you didn't get a chance to see Three Iron, you can watch that. You can also watch Woman on the Beach and hopefully be ready for that conversation. Again, that's in 2 weeks. If you want to get the entire listing of all six films, just go to filmspotting.net and click on marathons.
We'll be back with our 2013 fall movie preview. That's fall, Adam. So December's The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug, it can't be on your list.
My favorite title ever.
Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
My brain makes drugs to keep me slow. A hilarious joke for some dead pharaoh. But now not even the masons know what drug will keep Nat from coming. There are so many tools that are made from my hands, but the tide smashes all my best laid plans to sand. And there's always someone to say it's easy for me, but I revenge myself all over myself. There's nothing you can say to me. You never held it. Catch a falling star because you can't hold it.
Thank you, time here on Film Spotting, as we read the names and read a few notes from some of those listeners who sent some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. They really do keep us doing what we're doing, including Josh. And we have four new names. A gold-level donor.
That would be Adam from Gahanna, Ohio.
And a new $5 a month subscriber.
Brian from Indianapolis, Indiana.
We also want to thank Eric in Grand Rapids, Michigan for his donation.
You guys sure know how to get me to donate. Just read my name on air. True, it was only from the comments section of the poll question, but still, flattery will get you everywhere.
That really is the reason why we've added more feedback to the poll questions,
just to try
to get some more goodwill and earn a few more dollars. We also heard from another Eric, though this is Eric with a K, in Fargo, North Dakota.
I've listened to the show for a long time, and the forum has been a rock over the past few volatile years. Thanks for creating this vibrant film community and keeping it going.
Well, I hope things are looking up for you, Eric. Thank you for your donation and those comments. I'm glad that he got a plug in there for our Film Spotting Forum. Occasionally on the show, we like to throw out a kind word about the Film Spotting Forum. New and improved, I should say, because I've been dropping some cash lately, Josh, on improving the speed of our website. And it literally went from like driving a jalopy to, you know, you're driving a Porsche now, at least.
Nice.
A risky business era Porsche.
That was a good improvement to make. Yeah, I like
that. It really does hum along so much faster. And a lot of things have been restored. If you were one of those people who was really into the forum before and maybe went away because of the speed, because the chat was disabled, because you couldn't search, all those things are back. So it really is improved, and it's a great community, great people over there, and we rely on them a lot for feedback on the show and ideas as well. If you are someone who wants to support the show but aren't ready to donate or just don't have the extra cash to spare, you can help us out by going to iTunes and sharing a rating or sharing a few positive comments about the show. If you do like us, it just takes a second. You don't even have to say anything. Just give us that 5-star review. It can really help get the show in front of more new listeners. Finally, we did want to throw out a quick plug here, Josh, for a longtime monthly subscriber to the show, a guy named Scott Kaczynski in Brooklyn, New York. And he's writing to say thanks, in addition to getting a word out there or two about his movie. But he's been a longtime listener and actually says that he thinks that the analysis and our film critique has informed and shaped the way he views movies and now how he makes them.
I've just completed my first feature film. It's called Trust, Greed, Bullets, and Bourbon. And I feel without film spotting, it would have been something very different and, in my opinion, not nearly as good. The film stars Max Casella, Danny Burstein, and Dara Coleman. And so far, it's gotten into two film festivals, Knoxville and Orlando. Fingers crossed it will get in a couple more. I would love to meet up with other film spotters in those cities. I'll add it to the forums. I do plan to get you a couple copies of the film once it's completed, and in the end credits, you can revel in the fact that film spotting is listed in the special thanks.
How about that? We've made a graphic novel before on the marquee of a theater, if I remember correctly.
Not bad.
Now here we are getting a special thanks in an actual movie.
I hope you find the stakes high enough, Scott says.
Yeah, and he does send us a few links if you're interested in learning more about the film. That's trustgreedbulletsandbourbon.com. We'll link to that in the notes for the show at filmspotting.net. I should note that the actors he mentioned, Max Casella is an Inside Llewyn Davis and the recent Woody Allen film Blue Jasmine. Danny Burstein is a four-time Tony Award-nominated actor. Dara Coleman, we've seen recently in Ed Burns films like The Fitzgerald Family Christmas, Newlyweds, and Nice Guy Johnny. So has a good cast. There are some name actors there in that film. And since Scott has been a longtime donor and actually included us there in the credits, wanted to give him a shout-out. Also want to give a shout-out to our featured artist this week, music from former Chicagoan Nico Case from one of the most highly anticipated albums of the fall and her first album since 2009, which is hard to believe. We've played Nico Case for a long time here on Film Spotting, actually going back to 2005. The album, you gotta love this title, The Worst Things Get, The Harder I Fight, The Harder I Fight, The More I Love You. It actually just came out this past Tuesday, and she's playing the Hideout Block Party here in Chicago this Friday, September 6th. So depending on when you're hearing this show, you might be able to get there in time and catch Nico Case.
I'll be there.
You're going.
Yeah.
Really
excited about it. Can't pass it up because also Mavis Staples the same night. So
no kidding.
That's going to get me out of the house. I haven't been to the Hideout in quite a few years.
No,
but
me
can't
neither.
Wait to go
and
back.
And then on Saturday night, it's Film Spotting Double Date Night.
I know.
We're
it's going to be a
out.
Busy weekend.
We got dinner. We got a play. Can't wait to see Michael Shannon on stage here in Chicago. So it's a fun weekend away. Apparently, Josh really doesn't love his children.
We're shipping them off somewhere.
More information about Nico Case. If you don't know, that information already is available at nicocase.com.
Did it poison my food? Is it cause I'm a girl? If I puked up some sonnets, would you call me a miracle? I'm gonna go where my urge leads no more. Swallowed waist deep in the gore of the forest.
Hi, my name's Steve Coogan, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
I've heard tell about you. I heard you've been telling everybody that Mandingo's ain't no damn good, ain't nothing nobody is selling is worth buying. I'm curious. What makes you such a Mandingo expert?
I'm curious what makes you so curious.
What did you say, boy?
Calm down, Butch. No offense given.
You're listening to Film Spotting. That's Leonardo DiCaprio as Calvin Candy in one of our most anticipated films of the entire last year, but also last fall. That's Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained. Leo DiCaprio is back this year in another highly anticipated film by us and many Film Spotting listeners, The Wolf of Wall Street from Martin Scorsese. It's their fifth collaboration together. Alas, The Wolf of Wall Street will not make our top five, Josh. It could have.
It deserves to.
Excluded it. You're right. It definitely deserves to, along with two other films we excluded because they're just too damn deserving. They happen to be the three movies that we agreed somehow. We agreed on three films that we said, you know what, these would definitely make our top five, would probably be our one through three in some order.
Yeah, I think so.
And our listeners already are well aware of these films, so let's maybe go a little deeper, a little bit more obscure with some of our picks. So in addition to The Wolf of Wall Street, we're also excluding
Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity with George Clooney and Sandra Bullock, and 12 Years a Slave starring Chiwetel Ejiofor, and also your guy?
My guy.
Michael Fassbender.
With his guy as a director, Steve
his
McQueen,
director,
this
yep.
will be their third collaboration after Hunger and Shame. So absolutely, 12 Years a Slave, one we really want to see. That comes out October 18th. Gravity, a couple weeks before, October 4th. And The Wolf of Wall Street opens on November 15th. So aside from those three movies, Josh, what are we really looking forward to seeing this fall?
One more caveat should be November 22 is our cutoff date.
Yep.
So that films after that, in case we want to do a holiday movie preview down the road. So a little smaller window we're looking at here.
Indeed.
With that in mind, number five for me, Machete Kills.
I'll be your handler. You ready for this?
good for calls, texts, tweets.
Watch it, they don't tweet.
The enemy may have a missile, but we have machete.
We did first encounter Danny Trejo's machete, who's a Mexican take on Shaft, basically, in the series of fake trailers that were between the two features of Grindhouse. The co-directors of the original Machete, Robert Rodriguez and Ethan Menekes, they gave him this feature, which was, you know, truly an exploitation feature, true to form in that sense. But it also had a lot of political satire to it, especially in regards to immigration reform. You got to think that's still a juicy topic for someone to go after with a movie like this. So I'm up for a sequel, especially one that adds Mel Gibson and Sofia Vergara to the cast.
I never saw Machete. I'm one of those people, like many, as I recall, I believe, Josh, who thought that the Machete trailer and some of those other trailers were the best part, certainly of the Planet Terror part of Grindhouse. That was not a portion I enjoyed, unfortunately, for Mr. Rodriguez, but I never did seek out Machete. You think it's worth my time?
You know, it is that joke played out, so if you think that's all you need, maybe give it a pass, but I think there's a little bit going on there, and it's quite a bit of fun. The sequel is going to come out October 11.
Well, as I was looking at my list and considering which movies I was most excited to see, I did go back and look at January, Josh, when we did our top five most anticipated movies of the year. My number one at that point was the Coen Brothers' Inside Llewyn Davis. That, though, comes out later in the year. It's actually going to come out around Christmas time, so not eligible for our list. My 5-2 picks, though, have all already come out. The World's End, The Grandmaster, Before Midnight, and Upstream Color. And I enjoy all of them to varying degrees. The Grandmaster, as we discussed earlier, may be a little bit of a disappointment, but the other ones all came through. So that was what I was looking forward to. Let's see if these movies hopefully turn out as well as those films did. I'm a little bit worried about my number five because, Josh, it's a movie that actually opens this weekend, and that means that some of the reviews have started to trickle out. I've seen some comments on Twitter, and it did almost make me rethink whether or not I'm that excited to see the movie. I'm sticking with it, though. It's the documentary Salinger about the reclusive, enigmatic writer J.D. Salinger. I'm one of those guys. Yes, I'm that cliche. I read Catcher in the Rye when I was 16 years old in high school. It changed my life. I said, if I ever have a son, I'm naming him Holden. And I had a son. I actually had three, but my firstborn son, I ended up naming Holden after that character. And that alone makes me, of course, curious to learn more because there is such an absence of information out there about J.D. Salinger. And there's been this kind of goofy campaign. I know you probably saw the press release or saw some of our colleagues having some fun with some various Twitter memes, but the Weinstein Company is almost treating this like it's The Crying Game, where they're suggesting that critics shouldn't spoil the big secrets they're going to reveal. It's just unprecedented access, and it's going to reveal so much. But that aside, that actually makes me less interested in seeing the movie because I know it's never going to deliver on that promise. But just the access they are claiming to have, some of the photographs, some of the people that they're interviewing who have never spoken about him before, I want to see it. I'm worried that it's over 2 hours long. There's not much footage out there on J.D. Salinger. You're not going to find a lot of photographs, of course, or a lot of film footage. So are they just going to keep cutting back to the same two shots of him? Maybe, and that might get pretty old after a while, but it does open here in Chicago this weekend, and I still am very curious to see it despite the early returns.
All right, I'll let you look forward to that one.
Thank you.
My number four is Carrie, which I'm honestly really more morbidly curious about than anything else because I've never sat through the original in its entirety. Here's a good excuse to catch up with it. And I think there's some interesting people involved here, too. Chloe Grace Moretz is in the Sissy Spacek part, and I think she's really good in Let Me In. She's shown some comic range on 30 Rock. I don't know if she'll need that here at all. I don't know what direction they're going to take this. But they do have Julianne Moore as well as Carrie's deranged mother, who was made campily famous by Piper Laurie in the original. And the director, curious choice for the director, Kimberly Pierce of Boys Don't Cry. So this is certainly not a hack, someone they're just handing the project to. She brings a certain perspective to it, and it'll be interesting to see what that is. Carrie opens October 18.
Yeah, Kimberly Pierce does seem like an odd choice because you don't picture her as a genre filmmaker making a horror film like this or even a remake. But she is someone, having read Robert K. Elder's books about filmmakers and their epiphanies, the movies that make them want to be filmmakers, or the movies they champion that other people don't appreciate enough. I think Kimberly Pierce is in both, and family is a recurring theme for her. She picked The Godfather as her big epiphany film, so you see that in her other films like Stop Loss and, of course, in Boys Don't Cry. So I'm curious about Kimberly Pierce. Chloe Grace Moretz is the big sticking point for me. I didn't see Let Me In, which doesn't make any sense because I was really looking forward to it. I love Let the Right One In.
probably her best film.
Caught up with it. It probably is, but everything I've seen from her since, I just feel like she's so self-aware on screen. She's someone who never seems to disappear into a character, and that somehow bothers me and distracts me as I watch her. So I don't know how I feel about her taking on that iconic Sissy Spacek role, but I'm curious as well because of Kim Pierce. My number four is another movie I'm curious about because of the director. That probably goes for a lot of my choices, but specifically this one because the writer-director is J.C. Chander, and the movie is called All Is Lost. Chander is the writer-director of the film Margin Call from 2011, actually earned him a Best Screenplay Oscar nomination, and this is a movie about a yachtsman. His yacht hits a shipping container, and obviously there's a lot of damage. He starts taking on water, and it becomes a survival movie out there in the middle of the ocean all by himself. I think of it sort of, from what I'm hearing about it, as Castaway meets 127 Hours, just without a volleyball or hopefully any self-amputation. But Margin Call is a film I did really like, and I know, Josh, you were a lot more mixed on it. It's a movie about an investment bank at the epicenter of the financial crisis back in 2008, and it's got this huge ensemble cast. Kevin Spacey, Jeremy Irons, Zachary Quinto, and many others. So just having Chander attached to this movie is something that makes me curious for All Is Lost. But that ensemble, too, is another thing where you go to this movie, All Is Lost, it's just Redford. It's just him on the boat all by himself. There aren't a lot of other people, and there's no dialogue. Margin Call is a film that really thrives on its dialogue. That's really the action of that film. And here it's going to be all physical because it's just Redford with nobody to talk to. And Redford's a guy who is a huge star. He's 77. He's been making movies since the 60s. I have no doubts that he can carry this movie, that he has the right presence for it, but it still seems like a real challenge for him, certainly a challenge for any actor to pull that off. How much are we really going to get sucked into this film where all we get to see is him in that boat the entire running time? So I want to see what Redford does with the role, but I also really want to see what Chander does with something that's such a departure from his previous film because of that absence of dialogue, because of the solo star, even though both films seem to be about characters in a crisis situation. That seems to be something he really responds to. So because of him and Redford, really want to see All Is Lost.
As long as it's not Redford staring at a computer screen talking about his stock reports.
How dare you?
Then I'll be
How
fine with
you?
It.
All Is Lost, I should note, opens October 18th.
You're gonna die, Joe. Our mother. Patty Bunger's gonna die.
The dark current runs. Fading swirls move along the surface for an instant. Silent, impermanent. Profoundly significant. As though something just beneath the surface has waked for a moment.
My number three is the adaptation of As I Lay Dying. I'm reading the William Faulkner novel now, partly because I never have, and partly, Adam, just to enrage you.
Well done.
Good. It traces a matriarch's final days in Mississippi and changes perspective among her family members and neighbors. This, as far along as I am in the novel, already I can see that this probably shouldn't be filmed. I mean, it's just so evocative. It's so sensory. It's a movie already. Reading it, you feel like you're inside a movie, and I don't believe it's ever been filmed before. I couldn't find evidence of an adaptation. Who feels like they're the one to finally take this on? James Franco, writing, directing, and starring, of course.
That can't end that.
So,
I think he's a comic genius. So
he is very funny, and this doesn't have a lot of laughs so far.
Probably not.
So, but he's got some range too. He certainly has ambition. We'll see what happens here. There are some other good people in the cast, or at least people you're trying to figure out how is this going to work, and you just want to see if it works. Danny McBride would be one of those.
Yeah.
Tim Blake Nelson also. We'll see what he does with it. So As I Lay Dying opens later this month, September 27.
Wow, that's one I managed to miss completely when I was doing research for this.
I hadn't heard of it before either. Yeah.
Might have made my list. Good pick. My number three most anticipated fall movie is another documentary, and an interesting counter maybe to Salinger, because it's another figure who is just as enigmatic, I might argue, and just as fascinating and complex, despite the fact that he's been omnipresent in popular culture for about 50 years. That's Muhammad Ali. The documentary is The Trials of Muhammad Ali, and it's a doc that covers basically his years in exile, where he was trying to overturn his prison sentence for refusing to go to Vietnam. As I said, I think Ali is just a fascinating character. You look back at him in his prime, whether you're a boxing fan or not, who is better at anything than Ali was in his prime at boxing? And you add the star power and the charisma to it. That just makes him even more interesting. He was far from a saint. I've read the book, The Ghosts of Manila. certainly there are some people that have vendettas out against him, and there's no way he could be all good. He certainly is a character who has his flaws, and I think we're going to see some of those different sides probably come through in this documentary. I'm also fascinated in general, Josh, by just the notion of how we as a society are willing to turn on our heroes. People like Ali, who are larger than life, and we revere them for what they do on a certain field or inside a ring. And then the second they do something that seems to be against what we stand for, all bets are off. You've castigated them. And Ali was someone who certainly was thrown out and was disrespected by most of mainstream America. So I think that that will be an interesting dynamic to watch on film. And I got to give a plug as well to Kartemkwin Films, who is producing this documentary, one of our local production houses, the documentary film company that gave us Hoop Dreams and all of Steve James's work, including most recently The Interrupters. Tim Horsberg is actually a friend and longtime listener of the show. He works for Kartemkwin, and just a couple notes he sent me. A lot of Ali experts who have seen the film are calling it the best film ever made about him. It features a lot of interviews like Salinger with people who have never spoken on the record before about Ali, and the director of the movie, Bill Siegel, he's actually going to be at select screenings here at the Music Box on November 8th and all that week. So November 8th is when it opens here in Chicago, and I'm guessing some other cities as well. That's The Trials of Muhammad Ali.
There's a strong tradition of Ali documentaries, too. 1996's When We Were Kings, which chronicled the Rumble in the Jungle fight between Ali and Foreman. That was a really good picture. So, yeah, this might be in that vein. He's definitely a personality, rich personality for something like this. My number two is going to be My Trouble at Sea pick. It's Captain Phillips, which is based on the actual hijacking of an American cargo ship by Somali pirates in 2009. It's mostly the people involved here that are the draw for me. Hanks still find appealing, whatever Tom Hanks is in, I think has some possibilities. The screenwriter is Billy Ray, who has done some strong work. Some of it's highly fictional, like Hunger Games adaptation, but he also did the reality-based Shattered Glass, the journalism drama.
Breach, which I think I gave a positive review.
Yeah, I wasn't as wild about that one, but Shattered Glass, really good. So there's some potential there. And the director is Paul Greengrass, and he's previously made a strong movie from something that I kind of thought had already been covered by news reports. That was United 93. He turned it into riveting drama.
Yeah.
Captain Phillips opens October 11.
You're right. United 93 is an amazing film. I don't know that Captain Phillips will quite be as riveting, as intense. I'm not sure many films could be. But I've seen two trailers for this film, Josh, and thought, okay, I'm interested in the storyline. I remember the news of this happening. I'm interested in Tom Hanks. But somehow I completely missed from watching the trailers who directed the film. And I just heard in preparation for this show that it was Paul Greengrass.
Okay.
No, I didn't know at all. I was like, okay, well, that does actually up it a notch in my estimation.
Yeah.
Because it's Greengrass, it's definitely an honorable mention for me. My number two is a film that opens November 1st. It is The Dallas Buyers Club.
Mr. Woodruff, you've tested positive for HIV. Have you ever used intravenous drugs? Have you ever engaged in homosexual conduct?
Homo, you say homo? You made a mistake. That ain't me.
Mr. Woodruff, we estimate you have 30 days left.
Newsflash, y'all. Ain't nothing out there can kill Ron Woodruff in 30 days.
It's a movie set in the mid-80s. It's based on a true story of a man who was diagnosed with HIV, basically given 30 days to live, and he began smuggling medication across the border into the country. And this is a movie that I'm fascinated by largely because of its star. Matthew McConaughey plays the lead character. He lost something like 40 pounds for it. It's surely going to earn him an Oscar nomination based on the Academy's history.
39
just
pounds,
because of that.
No nomination. 40 or more, you
exactly.
get one.
Exactly. Absolutely right. And he hopefully, Josh, will deserve it because the run he's on now gives me really high expectations. Killer Joe, Magic Mike, Mud. He's also in the Scorsese movie The Wolf of Wall Street. So he's making great choices now. He's picking great material, working with really good writers and directors. And I'm hoping The Dallas Buyers Club is just another one in that line. Jared Leto is also in it, Jennifer Garner. I'm really excited, though, in addition to seeing Matthew McConaughey, Steve Zahn and Dallas Roberts, two character actors I like a lot. So those two, along with McConaughey especially, and just the story, he's a character I was not familiar with. I'm not familiar with this trafficking of medication at all, so I'm curious about that as well. But it's really McConaughey here who's the draw.
All right, my number one is Enough Said. This features Nicole Holofcener, who's one of my favorite underrated filmmakers. She made Lovely and Amazing, Friends with Money, Please Give. And here she's giving a starring role to one of my favorite underrated comedic actresses, Seinfeld's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Now, she's at least underrated by the movies, I'd say. She mostly gets bit parts or has had a couple voiceover roles. In Enough Said, she's going to play a divorced woman who gets involved with a friend's ex-husband. And another reason I'm eager to see this, the ex-husband is played by James Gandolfini, yeah. One of his last roles before his death earlier this summer. So Enough Said is coming out also this month, September 20.
So Holofcener is another filmmaker we split on a little bit.
Don't Not care for fan. Any of her
no.
stuff?
No, I like
actively don't like it or just aren't impressed?
I think I'm probably just a little more stuck in the middle. That's the problem. We won't have a good debate about her because I'm not fired up about her work.
Very unassuming film, so she does get that response, yep.
My number one is a movie that is 3 hours long. It's more than 3 hours long, so I'm not excited about the running time. Come on, longtime listeners knew I had to make a comment about that. It is the winner of the most recent Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. Blue is the Warmest Color, scheduled for a Chicago release on November 1st. It is the first film that was awarded that prize. It went to both the director of the movie and the lead actresses, Lea Seydoux, and I know I'm going to have issues with this, but I'm going to give it a shot because it's such a fun name to even read, much less say, Adela Exarchopoulos.
Yeah, that was awful.
Thank you. It's a French movie. It's based on a French graphic novel, Blue Angel, about two young women who begin a torrid romance. And this movie made a lot of headlines for its extended graphic sex scenes. Some question the politics of it or the choices that were made by the director. From a lesbian and or feminist standpoint, is the movie depicting this relationship in a way that is appropriate or productive? And the author of the graphic novel actually wrote a long statement that I read a little bit of. I didn't want to spoil the movie for me, but I wanted to get a sense of how she felt about it. And she kind of denounced the movie, saying that, well, there were no lesbians involved in the making of the movie and that they essentially turn this lesbian sex into porn. It's there more to titillate viewers than to do anything else. And I think her exact words were she can't endorse the direction that the male filmmaker took, but she looks forward to hearing how other women feel about it. So she's not so up against it that she thinks there's only one way to see the film. She obviously does want to see what kind of conversation it starts. And I'm not sure what I, as a straight white male, is going to be able to contribute to the conversation, Josh, but I do look forward to wrestling with it. And the fact that it was the Palme d'Or winner, honestly, alone, subject matter aside, would make me curious about it because of the response. But I really do want to wrestle with some of those questions as well.
Isn't that a quick turnaround to get a U.S. release date, too, winning this summer?
Yeah, it usually is later, as I recall some of the previous winners. But Blue is the Warmest Color, my number one choice, scheduled for a November limited release. Those are our top five most anticipated fall movies. Josh, do you have any honorable mentions?
Yeah, there were a couple that almost made the list. I do have to mention The Hunger Games Catching Fire just because Hunger Games unexpectedly made my 2012 top 10. So interested to see what they do with the sequel. Nebraska is Alexander Payne's new film. He's back in his home state, but he's working from someone else's script. That opens November 22. Great Expectations, yet another adaptation, but this one from director Mike Newell and has the perfect, possibly the perfect Miss Havisham. Little stereotypical, but still fits just right. Helena Bonham Carter. That opens November 15. And one more here, a documentary, Dear Mr. Watterson, about Bill Watterson, the Calvin and Hobbes comic strip creator. I loved those as a kid. My own daughters are just devouring the books that I saved from them. Should be interesting because he's a guy who's kind of fallen off the map the last probably two decades, I think it is. So that opens November 15.
Well, I just have three here, though you mentioned some very good ones there that I'm also excited to see. Short Term 12, this is a movie that opens September 23rd that's gotten a lot of positive reviews. It stars Brie Larson from 21 Jump Street and other movies, a really talented actress. Captain Phillips, as you mentioned, Josh, because of Paul Greengrass largely. And The Counselor, I can't believe a Michael Fassbender project didn't make my top five. It is directed by Ridley Scott. Brad Pitt also stars. I think it's maybe, Josh, I'm hesitant just because every two falls or so, it seems Ridley Scott comes out with one of these prestige pictures that, based on the subject matter and the cast, just seems to be a no-brainer, slam-dunk, great film. And then I'm inevitably a little bit disappointed by it. So maybe just a little bit of hesitancy there, but I do want to see The Counselor that opens October 25th. please do send us your picks, what movies you're most excited to see, or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You could also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and @facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in limited release in Chicago this weekend, I've got four different titles, 36 Saints, Afternoon Delight, The Patient Stone, and Red Obsession. It's a documentary about China's economic power and how it's affecting demand for wine that comes from France's Bordeaux region. So some interesting films there potentially, but Salinger is the movie that is opening. It was my number five most anticipated fall movie. We'll see if the critics have this one wrong so far or not. In wide release, Riddick. This is the Vin Diesel film, the third movie in a series that started with Pitch Black in 2000, not to be confused with Pitch Perfect, because if it was the sequel to Pitch Perfect, Josh, I would be in line
right
now.
You'd be all about it.
I wouldn't be here. I would just be waiting for that movie to come out. So that's what's opening, limited, wide. We know what's out in theaters recently, Josh. What's your one movie to see? If listeners have a chance to make it out to the theater, what do you recommend?
You know what? I'm going to push for something that actually just came out on DVD because I caught up with it myself. One of its last theatrical showings a few weeks ago at the Beverly Arts Center here in Chicago, they showed From Up on Poppy Hill. And then just this past week, it came out on DVD. This is the Gorō Miyazaki directed film from earlier this year and this summer that's co-scripted by his famous father, Hayao Miyazaki. Really wonderful, worth catching up with.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see that out on DVD now because I did miss it when it played here in theaters. My one movie to see would still be The World's End, the movie that we discussed on last week's show from director Edgar Wright. I would also, though, cheat a little bit and mention Drinking Buddies. If you can't make it to the theater but you want to watch a movie on demand, that new film from Joe Swanberg starring Olivia Wilde, Anna Kendrick, my guy Jake Johnson, definitely worth catching up with. Next week here on Film Spotting, it is time for another Film Spotting Sacred Cow review of 2001's A Space Odyssey. In conjunction with that, we're going to share our top five Stanley Kubrick scenes.
We need suggestions for that
one. We do need suggestions. Please help us, because it's not as if we're going to have a chance to actually go back and watch all of these films again. Michael Phillips, the venerable film critic from the Chicago Tribune, will be here to help us with that top five and with our review of 2001.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our featured music this week was from Nico Case. Her new album is The Worse Things Get, The Harder I Fight, The Harder I Fight, The More I Love You. It's actually out this week. You can find more information at nicocase.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.